Welcome back, fellow Richie Rye reviewers, where we read books and we review them. On episode 2 of my blogcast, I will be reviewing The Catcher in the Rye, sharing my personal experience, and finally discussing whether I recommend the novel or not. Now that we are familiar with the characters, let's dive right into the development of events since we last left off. Since leaving Pensy Prep, Holden has been bouncing around New York City with short-term stays in hotels. He begins to feel very lonely and reaches out to various old friends of his. He searches for his younger sister Phoebe in the city, who he speaks of very highly. He buys Phoebe her favorite record, but is ultimately avoiding his family as they have not heard the news of his expulsion. Holden gets in an altercation with the elevator man in his hotel due to underpaying a local prostitute. It is apparent he struggles fitting in and spends most of his time there alone. One thing I have noted about Holden's behavior is his likeliness to have a mental disorder. He never speaks openly about it, nor does he have a clear diagnosis, but his actions lead to suspicions of a mental disorder. Due to the novel being based in 1940, it was less common for mental illnesses to be clearly diagnosed. Of course, in 2019, we have adequate technology and resources for this diagnosis, but things were not always that easy. Part of Holden's struggles could be rooted from his sibling's death, which was likely traumatizing for him. His younger brother, Ali, passed away from leukemia in 1946. Holden speaks of his brother's death in the following passage when he was asked to write a descriptive piece for his roommate, Stradlater. The thing was, I couldn't think of a room or a house or anything to describe the way Stradlater said he had to have. I'm not too crazy about describing rooms and houses anyway. So what I did, I wrote about my brother Ali's baseball mitt. It was a very descriptive subject. It really was. My brother Ali had this left-handed fielder's mitt. He was left-handed. The thing that was descriptive about it, though, was that he had poems written all over the fingers and in the pocket and everywhere, in green ink. He wrote them on it so that he'd have something to read when he was in the field and nobody was up at bat. He's dead now. He got leukemia and died when we were up in Maine on July 18, 1946. You'd have liked him. He was 2 years younger than I was, but he was about 50 times as intelligent. He was terrifically intelligent. His teachers were always writing letters to my mother, telling her what a pleasure it was having a boy like Ali in their class. They weren't just shooting the crap. They really meant it. But it wasn't just the way that he was the most intelligent member in the family. He was also the nicest, in lots of ways. He never got mad at anybody. People with red hair are supposed to get mad very easily, but Ali never did. And he had very red hair. I'll tell you what kind of red hair he had. I started playing golf when I was only 10 years old. I remember once, the summer I was around 12, teeing off and all, and having a hunch that if I turned around all of a sudden, I'd see Ali. So I did, and sure enough, he was sitting on his bike outside the fence. There was this fence that went all around the course, and he was sitting there, about 150 yards behind me, watching me tee off. That's the kind of red hair he had. God, he was a nice kid, though. He used to laugh so hard at something he thought of at the dinner table that he just about fell off his chair. I was only 13, and they were going to have me psychoanalyze and all because I broke all the windows in the garage. I don't blame them. I really don't. I slept in the garage the night he died, and I broke all the goddamn windows with my fist, just for the hell of it. I even tried to break all the windows on the station wagon we had that summer, but my hand was already broken and everything by that time. I couldn't do it. It was a very stupid thing to do, I'll admit it, but I hardly didn't even know I was doing it. And you didn't know, Ali. My hand still hurts me once in a while when it rains and all. And I can't make a real fist anymore. Not a tight one, I mean. But outside of all that, I don't care much. I mean, I'm not going to be a goddamn surgeon or a violinist or anything anyways. Holden was not the only one in his family affected by Ali's death. He states, "They always flop, though, and it drives my mother crazy when he does. She hasn't felt too healthy since my brother Ali died. She's very nervous. That's another reason why I hated the hell for her to know I got the axe again." It is suspected that Holden suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. This disorder is described to be a mental health condition that's triggered by a terrifying event, either experiencing or witnessing. Symptoms may include flashbacks, nightmares, and severe anxiety, as well as uncontrollable thoughts about the event. Although it is not correct to personally diagnose someone with a mental illness, it is likely that Ali's death was a trigger for Holden and continues to affect his mental state. When Holden explains that his mother is very anxious and has not been healthy since Allie's death, it is possible her mental health is also at stake due to the loss of her child. To conclude, I would recommend this novel to readers my age or others. I believe the content to be mature and would not recommend for younger readers. Holden is an eye-opening character who tells an interesting coming-of-age story. The Catcher in the Rye may even help educate readers on matters regarding mental illnesses. Holden's internal struggles are clear and provide readers with an element of curiosity. The novel is nothing short of entertaining and contains many twists in the plot. If you enjoy quirky characters with a bad mouth, this novel is definitely for you. Another instance which could have contributed to Holden's likely case of PTSD would be the death of his classmate, James Castle. Holden describes this traumatic event of his past in the following passage. There was this one boy at Elkton Hills named James Castle that wouldn't take something back he said about this very conceited boy, Phil Stable. James Castle called him a very conceited guy, and one of Stable's lousy friends went and squealed on him to Stable. So Stable, with about six other dirty bastards, went down to James Castle's room and went in and locked the goddamn door and tried to make him take back what he said. But he wouldn't do it. So they started in on him. I won't even tell you what they did to him. It's too repulsive. But he wouldn't take it back, old James Castle. And you should have seen him. He was a skinny little weak-looking guy with wrists about as big as pencils. Finally, what he did, instead of taking back what he said, he jumped out the window. I was in the shower and all, and I could hear him land outside. But I just thought something fell out the window. A radio or a desk or something. Not a boy or anything. Then I heard everybody running out through the corridor and down the stairs, so I put on my bathrobe and ran downstairs too. And there was this old James Castle lying right on the stone steps and all. He was dead, and his teeth and blood were all over the place, and nobody would even go near him. He had on this turtleneck sweater I'd lent him. All they did with the guys that were in the room with him was expel him. They didn't even go to jail.